I want to speak about one Rashi in this coming week's Sedra, the first one. By Yeshev Yaakov, Rashi brings down a Medrash, Bikesh Yaakov Leishev B'Shalva. Yaakov wanted to sit in peace, quiet, serenity. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Rebbeinu Shlom said, Lo dayim l'tzadikim, mashe mesukin lahem l'olam haba. It's not enough for tzadikim what they have in the world to come. Umevakshim leishev b'shalva ba'olam hazeh. And they want to take it easy in this world too. Miyad, kofat harov rogzo shel Yosef. Immediately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought on Yaakov the agitation of Yosef, the tzara of Yosef. You familiar with that Rashi? Okay. Does it sit well with you? The Mefarshim asked a very basic question on this Rashi. What is so terrible if a tzaddik would have some peace and quiet in this world? We know that not everybody can have both worlds. But not everybody can. It is possible for tzaddikim to have this world and the next world. What is so terrible that the Ribbono Shel Olam can't fargin Yaakov Avinu a little peace and quiet in this world? What's so terrible? We pray all the time for peace and quiet. We want Mashiach to come. Should have peace and quiet. What's so wrong that Yaakov should have peace and quiet? So the Torah Tamima, in his Sefer Tosfos Bracha, says there's a terrible mistake that fell into this Rashi. Printer's error. Because he found a Medrash that has a different word in it than the Medrash we have. And he says that answers the question. In his Medrash it says the following. Bikesh Yaakov Leishei B'Shalva. Yaakov wanted to sit in peace and quiet. Omar HaSatan, the Satan said, it's not enough with the tzaddikim having the world to come, they want this world too. It's not Chas V'Sholom HaKadosh Baruch Hu said it, the Satan said it. Doesn't answer the question at all. Because the Satan does not run the world. God does. The Satan can only bring up various complaints. Various complaints. So the fact that the Satan said it means nothing, because in the end God agreed with him and brought the tzara of Yosef on him. So in the end it's as if God said it. So what difference does it make? So we're back to the original question. What does it mean? So let me tell you what I think, but we're going to start with completely, seemingly different topic. We'll come back to this. B'li Nether. Start with a Medrash. The Medrash says the following. There were once two Rishoyim that were partners in crime their whole life. They robbed, they murdered, they're pretty rotten people. One of them died, and he went to Gehenna. And he was suffering in Gehenna for an amount of time, doesn't say how long. And one day, he sees that they are escorting the soul of his partner into Gan Eden. So he calls the Malach who's appointed over the Neshamos in Gehenna, and he says there must have been some computer error, because that's my partner. When I stole, he stole. When I murdered, he murdered. If I belong in Gehenna, so does he. So please bring him here to keep me company. And if he belongs in Gan Eden, so do I. So get me out of here. The Malach comes back and he says, I checked into it. There's no mistake. He belongs there, you belong here. Guy says, I get it. He bribed somebody. So just tell me how much he paid and to who, I'll double it. Just get me out of here. The Malach says, that's ridiculous. There is no bribery here. He says, I'll tell you why he's in Gan Eden and you're in Gehenna. Because you don't know what happened after you died. You see, one day you dropped dead in the street. And because you were such a despicable person, nobody wanted to bury you. So they left your body rot in the street for 3 days. After 3 days, somebody benevolently kicked your body into a hole in the side of the road, and that's where you're buried. When your friend saw this, it made such an impression on him that he began to rethink his whole life. Is this how I want to end my life? I'll die in the middle of the street, nobody wants to bury me? And he ended up doing tshuva, and he died a fully repentant, righteous man. He's in Gan Eden. You never did tshuva, you're in Gehenna. The man realizes that there's no hope, and he bemoans his fate. This medrash is in Koheles Rabbah, in the end of the first parak, on the pasuk, Mu'uvas lo yuchal iskon. There are certain things in this world that are crooked, that can never be corrected. And this is an example. Okay, now, before I go on, whenever I tell this medrash over to women, I have to add the following, because I am sure that some of you are thinking what I'm going to tell you now. You're thinking, this isn't fair, because the second guy had somebody to learn from, and the first guy didn't. Anybody thinking that? I thought so. A man never asked me that question. The answer is, the Medrash is not interested in telling me the in full stories of the lives of these two people. It just wants to tell me one small portion to bring a message across. Let me make you feel good. The first person had somebody else he could have learned from, and he didn't. And the second person could have ignored the lesson. So it's fair. Okay? So that's the end of that. Now continue listening to me and don't let that bother you. Next. Two things. Oh, wait a second. The angel, I forgot to tell you the end of the Medrash. The end of the Medrash is like that. The guy says, okay, I'll do tshuva now. And the angel says, I'm sorry, but it's too late. Don't you know the world you came from is like Erev Shabbos, and the world you're in now is like Shabbos. Somebody who prepares on Erev Shabbos has what to eat on Shabbos. You didn't prepare Erev Shabbos. You wake up Friday night, all of a sudden you want to eat. Now you want to do tshuva? It's too late. Should have done it before you came here. And don't you know, the angel said, the world you came from is like the dry land, and the world you're in now is like the sea. If you prepare your boat with supplies on the dry land, you have what to eat in the middle of the ocean. You set sail with an empty boat. Now it's the middle of the ocean. There's no supplies. And now you want to go and get supplies? There's no supermarkets in the middle of the ocean. Too late now. You should have supplied your boat before you set sail. And don't you know, the angel said, that the world you came from is like the city, and the world you're in now is like the desert. If you prepare yourself a survival kit in the city, you can survive in the desert. You can't get the survival kit in the desert. You got into the desert without a survival kit. Now it's too late. You should have done tshuva before you came here. This isn't the world to do tshuva. That's basically the medrash. Two things bothered me about this medrash. Firstly, there is a mishnah in Pirkei Avos that compares this world to the next world. Ha'olam hazeh doma leprozdor bifnei ha'olam haba haskein atzmecha beprozdor kidei shetikonish betraklin. This world compared to a preparation room to a castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room so you can get into the castle. If you don't prepare yourself in the preparation room, you can't get into the castle. You didn't prepare yourself, you can't get in. Why did the Malach tell him 3 mishalim and not a mishnah in Pirkei Avos? Should have told him that mashal. The preparation room in the castle. Not Erev Shabbos and dry land and sea and city and desert. And the second question, why was it necessary to tell him 3 mishalim? I'm sure the guy got the message after the first one. They're basically saying the same thing in different words. Why the need for 3 mishalim? So one of my balabatim, when I said this over years ago in my moshav, said to me the following. He said, Rabbi, you don't understand. That's Gehenna, listening to long drushes that aren't necessary. As a rabbi, I don't agree with that answer. That person is now one of my mechutanim. His daughter married my son. But in any case, that was his answer. So what is the answer? Why 3 mishalim and not the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos? in order to answer that, we have to understand really what the purpose of this world is. What are we here for? So, the rabbis tell us, the Ramchal speaks about it, and others, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creature, on a creation that could receive that goodness. And that goodness is himself. God wanted to bond with a creation that could bond with him, and that would be the ultimate goodness, the ultimate pleasure that that creation could ever experience eternally. That's what we call Olam Haba. Tzadikim Yoshvim Ba'atroseyem Barasheyem V'nehenem Iziv Hashchina. An eternal, intimate, close bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's what Olam Haba is. So, God could have created our neshamos, bonded with them, and that would have been the purpose of creation. Why do you need this world for? So the rabbis tell us that since God wanted this pleasure to be the ultimate, it had to be earned, because what you don't earn, what you get for free, you don't really appreciate 100%. It's called Nahama Dechsufa. It's bread that you're embarrassed to eat because you get it for free. So therefore, the Ribbono Shel Olam took that neshama, put it into a physical world in a body, and said, you create the relationship with me instead of me creating it with you. Now let's stop for a second and ask a question that nobody ever asks on this idea, which everybody thinks about, but people are afraid to ask. And that is the following. God could have saved a lot of time and a lot of money. He didn't have to create this world. He could have just changed one rule. He could have created neshamos that could appreciate what they don't earn. It would have been much easier. Now, who made that rule that people don't appreciate what they don't earn? I guess God did. So couldn't he change the rule? So why didn't God create a neshama that could appreciate what it doesn't earn, instead of creating this world so we could earn and appreciate it more? The answer to that question, the Ramchal in one place gives a somewhat of an answer, but it's not an answer. It doesn't answer the question 100%. The answer to that question is, there is no answer. But now let me explain to you why there is no answer. And that in itself is an answer. Our minds are very limited. If you don't believe me, I'll show you it is. We can only imagine things that are within our realm, but that we have a point of reference to. Something that's out of our realm completely, but we have no point of reference, we can't even imagine. I'll give you an example. Close your eyes, not too tightly, because I don't want to be the only person awake over here, and imagine nothing. You see nothing in your mind? Okay, put your hand into that nothingness. Okay, your hand's in the middle of the nothingness. That's not nothing. That's space. Try again. Nothing means no space. Don't even try. You'll get a headache. You can't imagine no space. You know why? Because we have no frame of reference to no space. Because we always have space. It doesn't exist in our realm. No space. Give you another example. Imagine something that you never saw and never heard of. Impossible. What are you going to imagine? A monster with 10 heads, 5 legs, 6 arms, arms, legs, and heads you heard and saw. Imagine something that no part of it did you ever hear of or see. It's impossible. Because you have no frame of reference to it. You can't imagine it. We can only imagine things that are within the creation. Things that preceded creation, are beyond creation, are impossible for us to imagine. Therefore, even our relationship with God, the name, the greatest name we have for the Ribbono Shel Olam, which we don't say, we only write, is Yudke Bavke. Yudke Bavke basically means Mehaveh, he's the one who is the creator. From creation on, God in creation we have a connection to. God before creation, we don't even have a name for. And that's why we're not allowed to ask what came before the world, what's beyond the universe, because it's not that it's awesome, it's impossible. We have no way, we have no frame of reference to something out of our realm. And therefore, you can't ask questions on why God couldn't have created the world differently, because that's a question on God before creation, which is way out of our realm, and I have no way of understanding that at all. So it's not just you can't ask the question, it's impossible. It's something beyond our comprehension. What we can understand is, once God created the world the way he did, what can we understand about it? But why he couldn't have created it differently is a question that's beyond our comprehension. Yeah?
So how can you explain inventions then? Because that got from like no point.
How can you spend, could explain what?
Invention,
but the label never looked like
anything.
But
they thought of something
different. What, inventions? Yeah, but those are all just compounds of various things that you know. Right? They're just put together.
So
just were developed.
Like
you can discover a lot of things if they're within this world. But things that are outside the universe, you have absolutely no connection to, we can't comprehend. That's the idea. Something that's in this universe, right, that is basically based on something that we know, just related to it or whatever, or the components of it that we can understand. Okay. In any case, so we're back to the purpose of creation was that God wanted to shower his goodness, himself, on a creation that could receive it. And in order for that to be the ultimate pleasure, it had to be earned. Now that also needs explanation. Most people feel or think that earning Olam Haba is like a Purim carnival. There's games to play. If you play the games and you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, you go and cash your coupons in at the prize booth. If you have a lot of coupons, you get a big bear, little coupons, you get a little bear. And that's like Olam Haba. In this world, there's games to play. They're called mitzvahs. If you play them right, you get coupons. If you, unfortunately, there's also games to play that you can get demerits. If you play them right, you get demerits. After 120 years, they punch your name into this master computer, add up all your coupons, subtract all your demerits, and give you a coupon to cash it in for a share in the world to come. It's not how it works. Because that wouldn't be the ultimate pleasure. I'll explain you what that means. Imagine if you wanted one of these very comfortable, plush, lazy boy chairs for your birthday. And you're imagining sitting in it and really enjoying it. And you were hoping that your Aunt Matilda would give you the chair. And comes your birthday, and sure enough, Aunt Matilda comes through, and she gives you the chair. And you sit in it, you think you'll enjoy it. Yeah. What happens if Aunt Matilda decides to buy you a sweater instead of the chair? Now you don't have your chair and you really want it. And you don't have the money to buy it. So you find a job and you work for a month, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day, to earn enough money to buy the chair. And at the end of the month, you go out and you buy your chair and now you sit in it. Do you think you enjoy it more? 100%. What happens? Why? You earned it. Yeah. No, but if you really wanted that, right, you'd enjoy it. And you'd enjoy it more because you put a lot of work into it. What about, they're not selling that chair. So you plant trees, raise them until you can cut them down for lumber, and make the frame of the chair. Mine iron, make it into nails, bang the frame together. Raise sheep, shear their wool, make the stuffing of the chair. Raise cotton, and spin it into material and make the upholstery of the chair. And now you sit in that chair. You think you'll appreciate it even more? You created it. It's your chair. So what you earn, you appreciate more than what you get for free. And what you create, you appreciate more than what you earn. So in order for Olam Haba to be really appreciated, It can't be earned. It has to be created. You have to make your Olam Haba. How do you do that? So the Ribbono Shel Olam gave us a Torah, but the Torah is not the only way of creating Olam Haba. The Torah is only a guidepost to what in this world is godly and what is ungodly. And every single second of your life, every single thing you're doing, eating, drinking, conducting your married life, social life, political life, leisure life, everything can be done in a way that's godly or ungodly. You can eat in a godly way, you can eat in an ungodly way. How do you know what's godly and what's not godly? The Torah gives you examples of what things are godly, but really it's not just mitzvahs and averas, but it's your whole life. B'chol drochecha do'ehu. You can know, and know over here means bond with God in every single thing you do. You can do it in a way that's more godly, then you make your neshama more godly. And after 120 years, you have a greater connection, a closer, more intimate connection with God. Or you can do things in this world that are the opposite, ungodly, and then you have less of a relationship with God because your neshama is less like Him. So every single thing, every single second in this world, you can create more and more Olam Haba. And every second is like that. It says there was a famous sinner, or an infamous sinner, and in the midst of a sin, something shocked him into doing tshuva. And he died. He was so intense, his tshuva, that he died. And a bas kol went out, Ashrecho Reb Elazar ben Durdoi Shemezumen la'olam haba. From that 1 second of tshuva, you got your olam haba. When Reb Yehuda HaNasi heard this, he cried. And he said, Yesh kol me'olamo b'sho achas. A person can acquire his olam haba in 1 second. So the Tosfos Rosh Yeshiva asked, what was he crying about? He should have been ecstatic. Wow, you can get olam haba in 1 second. What's to cry about? He said, because he realized then you can do it every second. There's no limit to Olam Haba. In mathematics, how many whole numbers are there? Infinite. You can always add another number, right? How many fractions are there between every two whole numbers? Infinite. Yeah? So that means in mathematics, there's an infinite amount of infinities. So in Olam Haba, there can be an infinite amount of eternities. There's no limit. Every second, you can create more and more eternity. Closer relationship to Hashem. And how many seconds do we let slip through our fingers? That's something to cry about. And the truth is that that shows how important life in this world is. Because life in this world, every second, you can create eternity. Let me ask you, a person who doesn't believe in Olam Haba, irreligious, secular person, just believes in this world. And then a religious person who believes in Olam Haba. To whom do you think this world is more important? The first person or the second person? Logically, should be the first person. The second person, I mean. And then, no, this first person, because I forgot which one I said first. The person who doesn't believe in Olam Haba, who only has this world, should obviously value this world more than the person who believes in Olam Haba. This world is a very small portion of existence. The main thing is Olam Haba, so this world is not so important. It's not true. Just the opposite. A person who doesn't believe in Olam Haba, and the whole purpose of this world is enjoy yourself. Eat, drink, and be merry. For tomorrow we die. That's it. This is all you got. Enjoy it. There is no second in this world that's intrinsically important. Because how much pleasure can you have in a second? Zero. Can't eat a steak in a second. Can't watch a movie in a second. Can't do anything in a second. The only thing that makes this world important for such a person is a lot of seconds. The more time you have, the more pleasure you can have. But even that's not enough. Because you could have a long time. You could be 20 years old in a coma in the hospital, and your quality of life is almost nothing. You can't have any pleasure then either. What can you do in a coma? So you need two factors to make this world important. Quantity of time and quality of time. If either of those is missing, This world is not important. There's no intrinsic value. From a religious person's view, every second in this world is the opportunity to create eternity. It's eternally important. No matter how much you have or what level. You could be 119 and a half and be in a coma in the hospital. You have very little quality of life and very little quantity left. And every second is eternally important. Why? What can you do in a second in a coma? You can think. As long as you're still alive. And even if the EEG machine says that there's flat brain waves, doesn't necessarily mean you're not thinking. It could mean that the machine is not sensitive enough to pick up brain activity. It's on a very low level. So in 20 years, they'll make a more sensitive machine and apologize for pulling the plug. Or it could mean that there is no machine that will ever pick up that brain activity because you're not thinking through your brain. But you're thinking with your neshama. And your neshama is still connected to your body. You're still breathing and your heart's beating. You're alive. So big deal. So you can think. We have 1 second to think. You can do tshuva. Change your entire life. Entire eternity. You can think about loving God, fearing God, mitzvahs that have to do with thought. And you're creating eternity. You could think about doing mitzvahs that you can't do, but every time you want to do a mitzvah and you can't do it, you get rewarded as if you did. So you can do everything in 1 second on the lowest level of quality of life. So to a religious person, this world is extremely important. Every second is valuable, eternally valuable. That is our understanding of this world vis-a-vis Olam Haba. And that is what it says in the Marshal in Pirkei Avos. This world is like a preparation room to the castle. Prepare yourself in the preparation room in order to get into the castle. Let's analyze that Marshal. Why do they make a preparation room for a castle? What's the purpose of making it? No, to prepare to go in the castle. Is there any other purpose? No. They build a room for one purpose, prepare to go in the castle. What do they equip that room with? Ping pong tables? No. What do they equip it with? Things to prepare you to go in the castle. Hair brushes, hair dryers, I don't know what else, cosmetics, whatever it is that you need to prepare to go in the castle. They don't put anything else in that room except things to prepare to go to the castle. What do they do in that room? Only one thing. Prepare to go in the castle. Nothing else. That is this world vis-a-vis the next world. This world was created for no other purpose than to enable us to create Olam Haba. God didn't have to create this world. He only created it to afford us the ability to create Olam Haba. And therefore, what is the world equipped with? Every single thing that God created. Animal, vegetable, mineral, stars, everything was created for one purpose, to enable us to earn Olam Haba. How that works, beyond my comprehension. But every single thing that God created somehow serves that purpose, in some way. And what are you supposed to do in this world? One thing, prepare for Olam Haba. Nothing else. That doesn't mean you sit in a corner and say Tillim all day and cram for your finals. What it means is that every single thing you do in this world, on every level, every sphere of life can be done in a way that makes you more godly or less godly and prepares you for Olam Haba. So there's nothing about this world that isn't for the sake of Olam Haba. That is the real mashal between this world and the next world. But go tell a Rasha who lived his whole life in evil, didn't you know the whole purpose of this world was for the sake of Olam Haba? Of course he didn't know that. He doesn't know it now either. He's just dead. He's not a big tzaddik and philosopher because he died. So the Malach didn't waste his breath in telling this Rasha the marshal of the mission in Pirkei Avos, the preparation room to the castle. It was beyond him. For sure he didn't know that. But he said to him the following. Look, you may not have understood that the purpose of this world was for the sake of Olam Haba, the total purpose. But maybe in your mind, this world was like Erev Shabbos, And the world to come was like Shabbos. It's not the same mashal anymore. Because Erev Shabbos, you do things for the sake of Erev Shabbos. You eat breakfast, you go to work a little bit. The major part of Erev Shabbos is preparing for Shabbos, but not the totality. It's not the same mashal. Maybe that you could understand. Maybe you understood that this world's a nice place, and there's things you do in this world for the sake of this world, but the majority you should have used for the sake of the world to come. Why didn't you do that? And even if that you didn't understand, the Malo said, but in your mind, this world was like the dry land, and the world to come is like the sea. Equal. Equally important. This world's a nice world, the world's a nice world. But you knew that one day your boat was going to set sail. Why didn't you prepare? And even if that you didn't understand, and in your mind, this world was a city. This is it. This is the Iker. And the next world was a desert. Desolate, meaningless to you. But you knew one day everybody has to go into that desert. Why didn't you prepare? And if you didn't do that, either you didn't believe or you didn't care. You deserve to be where you are. That's what the Malach told him. No matter what you thought, you should have prepared something. But the real Hashkafa is, there is no purpose to this world. There's nothing that a person does in this world that isn't preparation for the world to come. Now, let's one more point, and we'll put them together. When I was about 10 years old, the supermarket in my neighborhood in Miami had a contest. That's where I grew up, in North Miami Beach. And the Quick Check in my neighborhood had a contest. And the winner of the contest, first prize, was 15 minutes in the supermarket to take off the shelves for free whatever you could get. 15 minutes in the supermarket, take what you want for free. And a woman won the contest, and they invited the whole neighborhood to come and watch her claim her prize. So I was 10 years old, my brothers were younger, Aleihem HaShalom, and we went to see this woman claim her prize. I remember the woman came showing off the special sneakers that she bought so she could run fast through the aisles of the supermarket. She had two carts, one on each arm, so she wouldn't run out of place to throw the things in. And this is way before GPSs. She had a map of the supermarket attached to this thing around her head, right in front of her, like this, marked off the more expensive aisles where the things that were worth more money were in the supermarket, so she'd go to them first. They told her, lady, listen, we are going to blow a whistle. First we're going to say, ready, get set, go, blow a whistle. From the time that whistle blows till 15 minutes to the second is over, and we'll blow another whistle. Whatever you take off the shelves and put in your cart is yours. After we blow the second whistle, if you take anything off the shelves, it's ours. So get ready. So they said, get ready, get set, go. They blew the whistle, and she started running down the aisles like a meshugana. Within 5 minutes, she was sweating, short of breath. Now imagine if somebody would have gone over to her and said, lady, you look tired. Here's a chair. Have a seat. Rest a little bit. What do you think she would have said? Are you out of your mind? I have 15 minutes to take what I want. Now's not the time to sit down and rest. Now's the time for me to run. In 15 minutes, when you hear that other whistle, bring the chair. I'll sit for the rest of my life here. But right now, I can't rest. It's counterproductive. Now let's go back to the Rashi. Bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalva. What's the pasuk say? Vayeshev Yaakov. Where did the rabbi see that Yaakov wanted shalva, that he wanted peace and quiet and serenity? There's no hint in the pasuk to that. The pasuk hints to leishev. There's a difference between leishev b'shalva and to have shalva. The difference is the following. People can have peace and quiet in their lives, but they don't remain at rest. They take the advantage of having peace and quiet to be very dynamic. Instead of having tsaras that agitate you, you can agitate yourself to be very active and very dynamic. But the rabbi said, there's nothing wrong with shalva. There's nothing wrong with having peace and quiet in your life. But if you use it to remain inactive, that is not a positive thing. That's counterproductive. Because every second you can create eternity and you're doing nothing. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. Bikesh Yaakov leishev b'shalva. Yaakov wanted to remain at rest for a few minutes. Just take some time out. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Different way of reading it. Same words. But not the way I read it to begin with, which everybody reads it. Everybody reads it. The Rabban Shalom says, Lo dayim l'tzadikim asher besukim lo mabo. It's not enough what they have in the world to come. They want this world too. That's not what it says. Read it like this. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lo dayim l'tzadikim asher besukim lo mabo. It's never enough what they have already. Mavakshim leishay b'shalva. And they want to take it easy and remain at rest in this world. It's counterproductive. It's like the lady sitting down in the middle of the 15 minutes. I'm not going to let her do it. Get up. Run. Grab. This world, it says, the Gemara says, like a smorgasbord. Grab what you can. Because if you don't grab in this world, you won't have. Right? Smorgasbords over here are, you know, some nuts and cake. But in America, right, smorgasbord is, you know what a chasana is like. Right? I was once at a chasana, and I heard two men in front of me by this gigantic, you know, with the guys with the white gloves carving the roast beef, and they have, what's it called, every kind of food you could imagine, right, overflowing. I heard one guy said to the other, I didn't eat for 3 days in anticipation of this wedding. And I believed him. He looked like he hadn't eaten for 3 days, the way he was taking the food. And then, you know, when they have the chuppah, and they tell people, okay, please go into the room with the chuppah, and nobody wants to move because they're still eating. So they have the waiters coming and take everything out, and people fighting with them to keep it on the table, and people feel very, right, what's it called, what are you bothering me with this chuppah? I didn't come here for a chuppah, I came to eat this food. So this world is like that. Grab it before they start turning the lights on and off, and the waiters come and take it away, and there's nothing left. So it's counterproductive to remain inactive. You can have peace and quiet. Use it now to become more dynamic. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, I'm not going to let Yaakov Avinu take it easy. Because it's counterproductive. So I'm going to agitate him. And that agitation was special, Rabbi Akiva Eiger says. Because Yaakov Avinu was promised that if he died before all his children survived him, he was guaranteed a share in the world to come. If any of his children died before him, the guarantee wasn't there. So by thinking that Yosef was dead, Yaakov thought he didn't have a guarantee anymore, made him more dynamic. So the agitation of Yosef kept Yaakov on his toes, like keeping that woman moving in the supermarket during those 15 minutes. Now's not the time to rest. After 120 years, there's plenty of time to rest. Go to a cemetery, you'll see everybody's resting. This world, you have to be dynamic. Of course you have to sleep or whatever, but that's only for the sake of being able to renew your strength. But stop to take it easy, that's not what this world is all about. So, therefore, that's what the Rashi says. Omra Kodesh Baruch Hu, not enough what they have in the world to come, but Adra, it's not enough what they have in the world to come. I'm not going to let him take it easy because he's giving up eternity. That's what it means. Yes?
But I feel like this world, it's like if you put this woman in the supermarket for 5 days, she's not going to be running like crazy in the first 15 minutes. She's going to be running like crazy, I don't know, the last hour of the last 5 days.
If she's not smart. But that's if you, let's make the supermarket something different. Let's make the supermarket a diamond mine. And every second is another diamond. Are you going to wait till the last minute and throw a few diamonds in the last hour? Or here you can be a multi-millionaire, billionaire, or whatever. Every second is another diamond. Every second is another $1 million. Right? And if you understand that you can use every single penny of that, you need it all. You're not going to waste 1 second of the time that you have. Unfortunately, that's the way we feel. Okay, I don't need to work so hard. I'll wait, you know, till I'm 100, and then I'll chop a few mitzvahs or whatever and put them in my pocket. But if you really believed that every second was a diamond, you wouldn't give up those diamonds so easily. Yeah. No? Anybody else have any questions on this? Okay, we have a few minutes. I'll just tell you one more Rashi. It's difficult Rashi in this week's Sedra. Also on Vayeshev Yaakov with a different pshat. The Medrash says that when Yaakov Avinu saw all the alufim of Esav in last week's Sedra, so he got scared. And he sat down motionless. What it can be compared to? To a person who sees a pack of dogs and he's afraid if he moves they'll attack him. So what do? You sit down motionless and hope the dogs won't attack because they don't feel threatened. So Yaakov Avinu sat down and was terrified of the Alufim of Esav mentioned in the end of Vayishlach. And therefore he sat down terrified. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said to him, Yaakov, what are you afraid of? I'll give you a marshal, says God. There was once a blacksmith and a flax dealer, a linen dealer, who were neighbors. And one day, the flax dealer sees that they're delivering camel load upon camel load of flax to the flax dealer. And he wonders out loud, where are they going to put all that flax? And one pikeach, one wise person, says to him, what's the problem? One spark from your bellows, from your fire, can reduce all that flax to ashes. So too, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to Yaakov, what are you afraid of all these alufim of Esav? Esav's compared to straw, and you're compared to fire, and Yosef to fire, and Yosef to a flame. One spark from you can reduce all of that to ashes. Now, I understand the nimshol. I understand the mashal. Here's this guy wondering, where are they going to put all that flax? And one real smart guy says, well, you could burn it, and then there's no problem. But the world is the mashal. Imagine if I owned a department store, and I saw that somebody is selling 1,000 stereos for the price of 100, because he needs the cash. 1/10 of the price. But there's one condition, you have to buy all of them. Can't buy some. If I buy 1,000 stereos at the price of 100, that's 1/10 of the price, I can sell them for a half price of what the normal price is, and I'll still make a tremendous profit. I can't let this deal go by. So I buy 1,000 stereos, but I don't have enough stock rooms to put them in. So I get all my stock boys together, and I say, we got a big problem. I had to buy these 1,000 stereos, but where are we going to put them? And one really smart stock boy says, I got a great idea. If we burn them, right, then we can reduce them to ashes and put them in one room. I fire that guy before he fires me. That's an idiot. That is not somebody smart who tells me they're going to store the what's it called, the stereos, by burning them. So what's the marshal? What I think is the following. A regular person hears a question, and he answers it. Where are they going to put all that flax? Room A, room B, room C. That's a normal, average person. A wise person says to himself the following. What in the world difference does it make to the blacksmith where they're going to put all this flax? That's not his question. His question is a different question completely. He's not asking a question. He's making a statement. Wow, look at what that guy has. Where are they going to put all of that? That's a business. What do I have? A bellows? An anvil? A hammer? A fire? Big deal. Look what this guy has. Look at all that flax. Where are they going to put it? He doesn't want to know where they're going to put it. He's amazed at his neighbor's business and he feels very small himself. So the pikeach, the wise person, answers the real question, not what appears to be the question. And he says to him, what are you so impressed with his stock What you have is much more potent than what he has. What you have is spiritual energy. What he has is physical, material things. One spark from you could reduce all of that to nothing. So even though what you have doesn't appear so strong and big, it's a lot more powerful than what he has. That's what the Rabbanu Shlom told him. Don't be impressed with the external physical things, because what you possess, which is internal, spiritual, is a lot stronger than that. That's what the Rashi means. That's what the Marshal means. And the truth is, that's a very good Hakdama and preface to Hanukkah, because that is exactly what Hanukkah teaches us. The Iker in this world is not the external physical things. That's what Greece represented. External physical things. It's the internal spiritual things. And that is the lesson of Hanukkah. Giborim b'yad chaloshim. We were weak and few, and they were many and mighty. And we won over them. Why? Not because we were weak and few. Because we were tahorin, tzadikim, oskei sorasecha. We had the spiritual edge, they had the physical edge. When it was a conflict, which one won over the other? The spiritual edge wins over the physical. The internal wins over the externals. That is the miracle of the oil. It doesn't make a difference how much you have. It could be a little bit, physically, materially. But if it's pure, it's going to last. That is mamish what Hanukkah is all about. It's the triumph of the inner spiritual power in this world over the external physical powers. And here in Eretz Yisrael, when I first came here, there were a lot of things that were culture shock. Very different between Chutz La'aretz and here. One of the things was Hanukkah. In Chutz La'aretz, the food of Hanukkah, at least in my time, was latkes. That's what you ate on Hanukkah, no? Latkes. And here in Eretz Yisrael, my first Hanukkah, went to a few Hanukkah parties, didn't see one latke. What do they serve over here? Sufganiyot, jelly donuts. Now what in the world jelly donuts have to do with Hanukkah? It was very culture shock. Now a latke, I understand what it has to do with Hanukkah, because it's made in oil, and you probably could put a wick in a latke and it would last for 3 weeks. Right, so it's reminiscent of the miracle, right? The oil of the latkes. And okay, sufganiyot are also made in oil, but it's not the same kind of thing. But I think the lesson of the jelly donut is exactly the lesson of Hanukkah. The ikar is not on what's on the outside. The ikar is on what's on the inside. That's what Hanukkah is all about. It's not the outside that's important, it's what's on the inside that is important. So this whole idea, this Rashi, what the Rav Shlom told Yaakov, don't be impressed with the external might and power of Esav, because what you have doesn't look as impressive, but it's a lot more powerful. That fire that you have, one spark of it could reduce all of that to ashes. Okay.